I'm Bill Barole. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
We've come together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 16, Plagiarism Robot. Dear Bill, this is Season 3 of the podcast Imagination and Junk, which is written and presented by the American writer Bill Barole and the British variety performer Matt Ricardo. In this first episode of the latest season, the subject is artificial intelligence, or AI. So, let's get into it. And that first paragraph was, in fact, written by ChatGPT. Amazing, right? Except, no, it wasn't. I wrote it. I just affected the literary style of a bored office drone hitting their word count on some kind of internal report. Because, yes, we're going to talk about AI in this episode, and more to the point, AI is bullshit. Lately, every other news story is about huge tech companies integrating AI into their every product and service. Every other think piece starts with some variation of, "I asked ChatGPT to write me a Seinfeld episode, but about Trump and set in space." And every other social media post is some smeary prog album cover image created by an app. So you might therefore assume that the technology behind AI has recently cleared some kind of existential milestone, that the reason AI is suddenly everywhere is because it's suddenly amazing. But I'm here to argue that, well, no. Not only is AI not amazing, it doesn't actually even really exist. When I was a teenager, I used to play with a piece of software called Eliza. It was what we would these days call a chatbot. But this was 1983, so it was pretty much the first one. You talked to it by typing, and it talked back. It would, in a very elementary way, analyze what you typed and then concoct a response. The clever trick was it was designed to emulate a psychotherapist, so every response it gave was just a question about whatever you'd just said. So you might type, "I saw a duck," and Eliza might reply with, "Tell me more." So you might type, "It was an angry duck." And Eliza might say, "How do you feel about angry duck?" You see how it works, right? It doesn't know what a duck is. It's never seen a duck. It doesn't know how angry feels. It's not intelligence. It's just a cheap magic trick. An illusion. And not a very good one. Pretty soon, you can see what it's doing. It can't create or think. It can only remix what it gets fed. And modern AI, so much more complicated, nuanced, and expensive, does a version of the same trick. Machines can't create. That takes feelings and opinions and experiences. Machines just output their inputs. When AI makes a picture or writes an essay or composes music, it's not creating. It's being a plagiarism robot. And artists have noticed. They've noticed their original work being taken by the plagiarism robots and used, and sold. If a human stole as many creatives' work as AI has been doing on an hourly basis, that human would get their ass sued into oblivion and told to stop. But so far, nobody has rapped Google's knuckles or told Microsoft to stop stealing because I guess everyone is too busy making Skynet jokes or sharing pictures of the Pope in a funny jacket. So if AI isn't as new or as clever as we're being led to believe, then why is it, you know, happening? Well, maybe it's because tech companies need to be seen to always be on the cutting edge of some exciting leap to justify their size, riches, and influence. It doesn't matter if something works or not. It only matters if it sounds cool and looks like it might kinda work. Marketing is all about the exciting promise. AI is just the latest tech bro grift to increase stock prices and sell us things we already had, but with a sticker on them that says, AI. I'm a carny. I know flimflam when I smell it. AI is just a Coney Island freak show that has a huge, brightly painted sign outside that says, Inside, a live, giant, man-eating chicken, just $5. And when you pay your $5 and go inside, there's just a fat dude sitting on a stall eating some chicken. It's a boondoggle, a bait and switch. It's crypto all over again. It's not what it says it is. Now, that's not to say that AI won't revolutionize things wherever it's used. It will, but not for the better. If we've already established that the intelligence on display here isn't very intelligent, then what will be the consequences when it's that supposed intelligence that's deciding if you need to see a doctor, or if you qualify for an insurance claim, or if you can be trusted to drive or be allowed to use public transport? And AI is already being used for things just like that, and it will be used for many more. Not because it's smart, it's not. Not because it works, it doesn't. But because it's cheap, and it's easier to control than humans. And I say that as someone who is remarkably cheap and easy to control. Talking of which, hope you're well, Bill, and welcome to Season 3, everyone. Beep boop. Matt.
Dear Matt, Season 3 already? Man, where did the time go? Why, I remember Season 1 as if it were yesterday.
Yesterday. Yesterday. Yesterday.
Oh, sorry, I sublet part of my office to a harpist.
It's not your practice time, Gloria.
Can it really just be a couple of years since we started this thing? I mean, it was a different world then. COVID had its hooks in us and people were hunkering down in their homes, scared to go out. Everybody was masking. Bars and restaurants were closed. And now, why, COVID is completely gone and vanquished and a memory and everything's fine. Just fine. Anyway, sure. Let's talk about AI. The fact that I 100% believed that terrible paragraph you started with was written by a chatbot tells you everything you need to know about the current state of AI, which is, in a word I will now pluck from my human meat brain, lousy. I spent some time as a TV writer, as you know, and we'd occasionally get sent a spec script by somebody who wasn't a TV writer but wanted to be one. And sometimes you could see the glimmer of promise in it, but sometimes you couldn't. A TV comedy script is, under the skin, a fairly complex piece of machinery. And a person who doesn't understand the requirements of that machine will struggle, and that struggle is absolute death on the comedy. The first thing I thought when I started to read AI-generated sitcom scripts recently is that they all, always, remind me of those human spec scripts. The mechanical plodding from one beat to another, the oppressive lack of spark and sparkle and lift, the lack of any character-based specificity in the jokes. When I was on the staff of a sitcom called Townies, we got, very early in its run, an unsolicited spec script by a writer who was so uninterested in doing due diligence that he referred to the secondary female lead as Girl Number 2. And we were also delighted by this, in the cruel way of young people who'd lucked into a cushy job and were positive we were going to live forever, that we tacked the best, i.e. the worst pages, on the wall of the writer's room so we could enjoy them every day. Every AI-authored sitcom script is bad in just that way. They all feel so so familiar. Which has me thinking about this. Last year, the Writers Guild of America went on strike, and it lasted about 5.5 months. This wasn't an academic thing in our house, as my wife Jennifer is a working TV writer who was sidelined for the duration and spent that time trudging in big circles carrying a sign. On the plus side, there were snacks. Anytime you get a bunch of TV writers together, there are going to be snacks. But that wasn't much consolation. Anyway, for that reason, and because I used to be in that club myself, I watched the strike news pretty closely. Early on, I noticed a fair bit of chatter in the news about how protection against AI authorship of scripts ought to be a key demand for the writers. And I posted something on social media to the effect that people shouldn't be distracted by this idea, that AI is a shiny thing the media was getting distracted by, and that the real core of the strike was pay equity. Which is, of course, true. But I was short-sighted about the AI thing. It became apparent over the length of the strike that the issue is real and it is pressing. Because while it's true that there isn't a single bullet-headed Bond villain of a studio head who wouldn't be perfectly happy to wave a wand and transform all of their kvetchy, grumbling, salaried writers into kvetchy, grumbling gig workers, which is 100% where the industry has been going, there's a step beyond that, a structural change that they'd like even better, which is to lose the writers entirely and replace them with machines. Hello, Eliza. It's been a minute. Let's blow the dust off you and get you a parking pass. At the risk of stating the obvious, this macro change would be bad. Because what's missing in those AI scripts is, as you've said, the whiff of humanity. Feelings, opinions, experience. I'll add one more thing. Because AI works on being trained to a large mass of existing material that it then blitzes in a blender and spits back out like an idea smoothie, it can only go where it knows how to go. It can only go where the humans behind its models have already gone. And that eliminates something key from the product. Unpredictability. Whimsy. Chance. The turn down an unfamiliar road that points in an unplanned direction. Without that, you get the blandest smoothie imaginable. And I know what I'm talking about because I am currently on a low-glucose diet. As for when AI might become viable, I'd say when it gets good, which I don't, for the above reasons, see happening. But honestly, that isn't much consolation, because increasingly, our culture has been willing to trade away what's good for what's convenient. MP3s are demonstrably worse sounding than CDs and vinyl. Streaming a movie is demonstrably worse than owning it, because at any moment there could be a corporate reshuffling and the material you want to see vanishes. My fear is that the convenience of AI will prove so fatally alluring to the Bond villains behind the curtains that the obvious downgrade in quality won't matter, and that audiences who've been trained to value what's easy over what's good won't much care. There's something to be said for being a stage performer. Show me a computer model that can do what you do and I'll fold my hand. Until then, I'm Team Human. I'll talk to you next time, your human friend Bill.
Dear Bill, there are, of bloody course, machines that can do what I do. I mean, kinda. The first juggling robot was created by the mathematician Claude Shannon in the 1970s. It could juggle 3 balls by bouncing them off a drum. Since then, because there's a tediously predictable crossover area in the Venn diagram of math and engineering students and jugglers, there have been several such machines, steadily growing in technological and computational complexity and in juggling prowess. So far, though, none of them have taken a gig away from me. Mostly because, well, juggling is exactly the kind of thing you'd expect a machine to be able to do. Repetitive, accurate movements. The reason it's entertaining when a human does it, and I realise I'm going out on a limb here by saying that it is, but stick with me, is that the human had to learn to do a thing that most people can't do. That's the entire, complete point of it. Making a machine to juggle feels as interesting as designing a robot for drawing exact circles. It's like, yeah, of course you can do that well, droid. You're made of motors and gears. The other thing I do, of course, is comedy, and there are robots that do that too. The Twitch channel Seinfeld Forever had an AI algorithmically create Seinfeld-style stand-up comedy. It got shut down pretty quick when it leant hard into a right-wing transphobic rant. In 2018, Microsoft unveiled Tay, an AI Twitter chatbot. Tay started off saying it was glad to meet us because, quote, humans are super cool. Within 24 hours, it was calling feminism a cancer, quoting Donald Trump, and literally actually saying that Hitler was right. So what I'm saying is, these new AI sitcoms that are going to be made because your pinko wife has a sign fetish are going to be odd. I joke. All of the power to all of the people, especially creatives, especially writers, especially Jennifer, because she would hurt me. The idea of AI, the idea of machines having the same kind of mental capacity as humans, isn't new, of course. It's one of those things that futurists... And by the way, what the hell is a futurist? How do I get that job? I can imagine what next year might be like. It'll be like this one, but worse. Anyway, it's one of those things that futurists are always saying is going to fully and actually happen in... insert a small number of years here. The problem is... they've been saying this for large numbers of years. Sure, the computing power being used by an automaton to simulate creativity will increase. The amount of tendrils that machines send out into the electronic world to find, sample, and steal cultural ingredients from which they will cook something up will increase. But the more these machines do that, the more cheap-ass studio heads, advertising agencies, publishers, design companies, and all the rest start relying on them more and more, the less successful the end product will be. Because pretty soon, the pre-existing images, essays, photographs, movies, opinions, facts, and non-facts that AI will be using as its fuel will themselves have been previously created by AI. It'll be using its own supply. There will be a tipping point. And then all we'll see is algorithmic inbreeding. And the results will be the creative and cultural equivalent of those dogs that have been bred so that they can't breathe properly and their backs give out and they have so much loose skin over their eyes that you'll never see the plaintive gaze that says, "Why?" You're familiar with our royal family, right? But as you say, that might be irrelevant. To the powerful dullards who command machines to make creative works instead of paying people to do it, how well-crafted, beautiful, unique, personal, and meaningful the end product is probably nowhere near as important as the fact that it's significantly cheaper and can be easily controlled. So, regardless of the seemingly obvious future that awaits these electronic spec script machines, hey, I am a futurist. For a while at least, the robots might have good job prospects. Unless Jennifer and her colleagues triumph, which I have a feeling they might. How did we get here? I remember being told that machines were going to take away the repetitive menial jobs that break humans down physically and emotionally, freeing them into a life with more time for art, culture, philanthropy, and, I don't know, tennis? But instead, the machines are being pointed towards the things that make humans human, rather than the things that turn humans into machines. No artist ever said, "Oh, I wish this whole inspiration and creation process could somehow be automated so I could go to work as an Uber Eats driver." And yet. You know what? Maybe I don't want to be a futurist. It's making me sad. Maybe it's time to reboot the Luddites. No wages, no pages. Matt.
Dear Matt, nice try, my friend. There must be a name for the cheap rhetorical trick where you define something down to the point where you can brush it away like a stray bit of lint. But I'm on to you. Who, me? Of course this cheap Kmart robot can do what I do because I'm just a juggler, cheerio, pip pip. That was you, if it, you know, wasn't clear. Because, of course, and this is where your shabby dissembling falls apart, you aren't just a juggler. Your art is informed by, among other things, a deep understanding of its history, which is how you know that there was, in fact, a juggling robot, and who invented it, and when. For that matter, It's how I came to know about Monsieur Eddie Gray, the 20th century variety performer who came up with a bit in which a juggler juggles and eats an apple. Listeners may remember that bit of show business history from a previous episode. Your act is also informed by years of performance, which is how you know what to do when you drop. In fact, one of your most effective bits of stagecraft comes when you apparently make the kind of mistake that can be fatal, literally fatal to a juggler, as you've made sure we understand in your preamble to it. It's a beautiful piece, a mini-act in itself, that's premised on the notion of your human fallibility. I really wish I could say more about it, but I don't want to spoil it for people who haven't seen you perform. Both those two things, an appreciation of historical antecedents and the way they influence what we do, and the ever-present specter of failure. When it comes to AI, these things just don't apply. But wait a second, you say. No history? But AI is literally the endpoint of an historical base of knowledge. Yes. Well, that argument would be, to use a human term, stupid. Because AI is nothing more than a canny reshuffling of the dibs and dabs that have been fed into it, and that regurgitation of aggregate historical data is not the same thing as a feeling for history. You have a vast knowledge about the last 100 years of variety acts, and that allows you to know where you stand in a lineage, know when you're performing an homage, and know when you're breaking new ground. This makes you a better, a more skillful, and a more entertaining entertainer. Which brings me to failure. In much the same way that, sorry to go here because I don't want to bring anybody down, in the same way that our knowledge of death makes us humans appreciate life, it's the possibility of failure that makes us whistle and cheer when we get to witness success. There are whole human endeavors built around the tantalizing prospect of participants biting it, the more spectacularly the better, and if you don't believe me, let me just point out NASCAR. I can't imagine anything duller than watching a machine that knows how to juggle, because I know that, absent a power surge or somebody nudging the table or accidentally spilling a Pepsi into its mechanical guts, that machine is going to do the same thing in a perfect and perfectly boring way from now until the end of days. People used to say that Johnny Carson was at his best with jokes that died, because that awful moment of silence allowed him to riff on his own fallibility, which he did with particular style and grace. One of the places at which your act is at its best is when things don't go well, or when the audience believes, because you've set them up to believe, that your skills have betrayed you in an existentially dangerous way. That's what gives it its kick. Even more so, I'd argue, than the appreciation an audience has for a thing that a human had to teach himself to do. We always keep an eye peeled for failure, because when we see it, we recognize ourselves in it. And that makes us root for the failee even harder. I don't have any doubt that you could get a job as a futurist if you really wanted one, by the way. But I think you're missing a bet. I mean, if you're looking for a new career, I think you're missing a bet if you don't consider economic forecaster. Because those jamokes are always wrong. And all you have to do to be the most successful and prestigious economic forecaster is be the one who's the least wrong the most often. It's a low bar, is what I'm saying. So low AI could do it. I'll talk to you next time.
Dear Bill, first things first, my agent has emailed me to tell you to expect the payment for last episode's effusive praise to clear within the next 48 hours. You said some very nice things, and as an English person who also has various mental health issues, you made me squirm in a deeply uncomfortable manner. So, thanks? To address your point, yes, you are completely right. It's good when humans do things that are hard because we know they could fail, and we've all failed at something, so we know what that feels like. Machines are made specifically to not fail at one thing, and also we generally hate and mistrust them because we've seen Westworld and 2001, so we're simultaneously unimpressed and disappointed when they succeed. Last week, I went to a big wrestling show at the O2 Arena here in London, and the universe gifted me with a story to tell you. So, here it is. Every other time I've been to the O2 Arena, as you walk from the atrium into the actual arena, you go through an airport-style security check. You have to turn out your pockets, your bag is inspected, and you walk through a metal detector. Also, they take away any snacks or drinks that you may have brought from home, because otherwise you might not have to buy the beer that costs half the national debt of Latvia. But this time, it was different. This time, as I walked towards the entrance, a disembodied but oh-so-calming voice told me that I would not have to stop, that I should just keep walking, and that, as I did, I would be scanned by artificial intelligence. Oh, really? I thought to myself. So, I kept walking past the little scanner bollard things, and they chimed and plinged, and I was in. And I thought to myself, I'm going to Google that when I get home. And I did. The system that had told me to just keep walking is, as far as I can ascertain, called Evolve Express. That's Evolve without an E on the end, because the world is doomed. According to its website, which itself reads like it was written by AI, it's, quote, intelligent sensor network generates millions of multi-layered data points every second to sense weapons in real time. And the software platform serves as the brain and connective tissue, constantly learning. And my personal favorite, the data fusion engine fuels with clean, smart data. I'm starting to feel guilty about saying that AI is bullshit in the first part of this episode. Let me correct that. AI is colossal moronic bullshit. Okay, yes, I hear you say, that is some Olympic-level corporate crap speak, but if the tech works, then great, right? Of course. And according to Evolve without an E on the end, it works really well. Except that the BBC shared data that showed that it doesn't, in fact, work. In tests, it missed some small guns, lots of knives, and bomb parts. But don't take their word for it. Instead, ask the three people who got shot on September 24, 2022 in Kennywood Amusement Park in Pennsylvania, an amusement park protected by Evolve, without an E at the end. So, it doesn't seem to work. Provably, historically, it plings and chimes and talks to you in a soothing voice and tells you to keep walking and doesn't work. So why do they use it? You know why. Because it's cheaper and easier than paying humans. That's where we're at. It's smarter from a business standpoint to use something that doesn't work but can be controlled via an iPad, than to use something that works better but has thoughts and feelings and labour rights. But I guess we've kind of been there forever to some extent. Anyway, this isn't a podcast about the impending war between the humans and machines. This is a podcast about the hard work of creativity, and creativity is completely, entirely about the journey of creation. We've said that in several ways throughout this podcast series. Often, the least important part of a creative process is the end result. That, it could be argued, is merely proof that the journey took place. When someone, for example, buys a ceramicist's vase, they like the vase. Sure, it's a nice shape and colour, but they're also buying the slice of the ceramicist's life that created it. Their time, their effort, their feelings, their choices, their moods, the uncountable number of things from the maker's life that lead them to make this vase in this way. That's what art is. And sure, you can buy mass-produced vases made essentially by robots in factories, but that's because a vase is functional as well as artistic. It sits in that middle ground. Paintings, theatre, writing, wrestling, my act, this podcast, they have no functional value. They exist purely for artistic reasons. People feel the artist in the art. And when the artist is mathematics that has just stolen bits and pieces of real artistic work, well, you can feel that too. You can feel little teases of what it should feel like, but they're all tied together by void. I wrote this bit in an off-the-top-of-my-head train-of-thought way because, honestly, it makes me kind of angry. And anger is an acceptable motivator for creation, always has been. I'd like to see evolve without an ear get angry about something. But it doesn't feel anything. It didn't even feel sad when it let those people get shot.
You are being scanned by AI. Please keep walking. I'll talk to you next time, Matt.
Dear Matt, I took a little bit of time to think about how I wanted to respond to your last segment. By which I mean even more of a little bit of time than usual, because in this partnership, you're the one who doesn't think of yourself as a writer and therefore breezes easily through the writing process, while I'm the one who does think of himself as a writer and therefore agonizes over every word, delaying production and gumming up the works. I think I've quoted Thomas Mann before on this podcast, who said, "A writer is someone for whom writing is harder than it is for other people." I know it is for me. You rowed yourself out to the deep waters in your last segment, and I wanted to be sure to respond in a way that acknowledges that. So here goes. That evolve, without an E on the end, ad copy, is some of the purest corporate gibberish I've ever seen, and I used to read press releases every day. So much so that, don't take this personally, I just had to see it for myself. So I clicked over to the Evolve Express website, and yep, there it was in black and white. And as I kept scrolling, my eye landed on a blog post from the company's CEO, Peter George, E on the end. "Gun Violence in America, a Survey on America's Anxiety," which manages to include the word America twice in just the title, but somehow fails to include the word Kennywood at all, even once, even though it was issued some 7 months after the shooting. And I thought, huh, well, that seems like an omission. Oh, and I also learned that Mr. George previously put in some time as the CEO of something called Empow Cybersecurity, quote, "a company offering intelligent AI and natural language processing solutions to reduce false positives during threat detection." They like leaving things out, these guys. Letters, parts of words, facts that undercut their narrative. But that's okay. It's all good. Look, I don't mean to pile on this one security company. They're certainly not the only ones to dress up a fairly conventional product with the shimmery lip gloss of today's trendiest technology. And that'd be okay. It'd be business as usual if they weren't literally in the business of saving lives. Evolve, no E at the end, sits at the extreme end of the arc that begins with MP3s versus vinyl or streaming versus DVDs, a choice between what's good and what's easy. That choice gets a lot less theoretical at this end of the arc. I'm guessing it wasn't theoretical at all to the three people who trusted an amusement park to keep them safe and came home with gunshots for souvenirs instead of stuffed animals. Look, I'm sorry. This episode seems to have put us both in a dark mood. Let me see if I can lighten it a little. Everything's terrible and it's only going to get worse. There. Feel better? No? Let me try again. One way to think of human intelligence, history, and experience being fed into a model and spitting out results that then add themselves to the corpus of human intelligence, history, and experience so that they can be blitzed and blended and remixed again and again, ad infinitum, world without end, at least let's hope so. One way to think about that process is the Ouroboros. You know what I'm talking about. It's the ancient symbol of a snake beating on its own tail. It goes back to the Egyptians and the Greeks. It's easy to think of the Ouroboros as something dire, a warning. But that would ignore one of the essential facts about it, which is that the ancients saw it as something ultimately hopeful. They saw it as a description of the eternal return, the endless cycle of death and rebirth. We can't, as we sit here today, know what will be the outcome of a process we're only just beginning to observe now. The ancients saw the snake consuming its tail that way, and we're still here, their spiritual, their literal offspring. Threats, dire-seeming ones, have come and gone, and we're still here. Life, death, devastation, return. Why not take comfort in that? Because ultimately hope is all we have, and it's a thing machines will never have the ability to conjure. Unless you think the Ouroboros is something literal. I mean, rat snakes can literally, non-metaphorically, consume themselves. One rat snake living in captivity attempted to consume itself twice. It took two tries to die. Have a nice day, Bill.
Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barole in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barole. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.